as movies Edward Scissorhands, Batman, Beetlejuice, and Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Also, we meet humorist Christopher Cerf, the writer of such Sesame Street song parodies as Born to Add and The Monster in the Mirror. Cerf co-authored a new book that cashes in on the current movie sequel mania, with dozens of proposals for movie and book sequels. What do you think of I Was a Teenage Beowulf? Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews John Harbison's cantata The Flight into Egypt. Featuring Boston's cantata singers, it's the first recording of this Pulitzer Prize-winning piece. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new biography of Russian writer Vladimir Nabokov. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney said today all U.S. forces will not be in place for a full attack on Iraqi troops by January 15th. Army Lieutenant General Calvin Wallard, deputy commander of U.S. forces in the Gulf, added it could be as late as mid-February before they're ready for combat. They made those assessments in Saudi Arabia, where Cheney is holding military briefings. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
Secretary of Defense Cheney arrived in Saudi Arabia today with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Colin Powell. Cheney said he thinks most of the U.S. forces will be in the Gulf by January 15th, but said there's additional work to be done before you would identify them as combat ready because it takes time to get organized, marry them up with their equipment, and get them acclimated. The Army's 7th Corps, based in Europe, will add 100,000, more than half of the new troops, to Desert Shield. So far, the inflow has been slow, and General Waller said late-arriving armored units would not be ready until perhaps mid-February. I'm Ann Garrels in Saudi Arabia.
Two U.S. senators just back from a trip to the Persian Gulf say that military commanders told them a war with Iraq could be wrapped up within 5 days. Alaska Republican Ted Stevens and Hawaii Democrat Daniel Inouye spoke with reporters after briefing the president on their trip. The two senators said they got their information from briefings they received during their tour of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Egypt, and Israel. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater declined to put a specific number of days on any possible war with Iraq and said, "We're not talking about war, we're talking about a peaceful solution." The United Nations Security Council has failed again to vote on a resolution on Israeli-occupied territories. But officials say only a few differences need to be worked out before the measure is ready for a vote. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
The Security Council voted again today to postpone action on the resolution to allow more time for negotiations. The motion barely passed, with France and China now opposing any more delays. The Council has been trying for nearly 2 weeks to come up with a resolution and avert a U.S. veto, but there are signs a compromise may be near. Klaus Tornut is Finland's ambassador.
There are still a couple of problems which remain to be settled, but which, in our opinion, could be settled very quickly.
Some of the unresolved disagreements relate to the proposed peace conference on the Mideast. The U.S. wants wording that explicitly states that the conference is unrelated to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, but the wording is opposed by the measure's 4 non-aligned sponsors. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average remained the same today to close at 2,626.73. Advancing issues led declines by nearly 4-3 in active trading. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Tim Burton, directed last year's blockbuster Batman, but his first two films were smaller, idiosyncratic fantasies, Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice. Burton has returned to a smaller scale in his new film, Edward Scissorhands. The movie is set in a generic suburb. Well, maybe not exactly generic. The road at the end of this suburb leads up a steep hill to a Gothic castle. As the movie opens, an Avon lady, played by Diane Wiest, is having no luck selling her cosmetics door to door. So she drives up the hill to the castle and finds a young man with wild hair and a sensitive, innocent face who has scissors instead of hands. Johnny Depp plays Edward Scissorhands. Edward Scissorhands isn't really human. He was created by an inventor, played by Vincent Price, who used to live in the castle. But the inventor died just before he was going to give his creation hands. The Avon lady takes the isolated Edward Scissorhands back to her home in the suburbs. The movie takes the form of a fairy tale. Burton grew up loving monster movies and horror films. I asked him why this time he created a fairy tale.
Well, I'd always liked the idea of fairy tales. I always like the imagery and fairy tales, myths, fables, things like Hansel and Gretel and Little Red Riding Hood. Even though I like the imagery, they never really connected with me completely. And I just always had the desire to, you know, make a fairy tale that was, that had all of the, you know, elements, the visual quality of a fairy tale, but, you know, something that maybe would connect a little bit more.
Connect more by being more alienated.
Well, connect more in the sense that, you know, these things, fairy tales always have this wild sort of very visual imagery, and yet you know there's some sort of psychology beneath it, but yet I always had trouble understanding it. That's why I always liked that Bruno Bettelheim book, because it really, you know, explained and opened up what fairy tales are and what they mean.
When and how did you get the image of Edward as a lonely boy, you know, who'd been created in a laboratory with scissors for hands? What came to you first about that, and what was behind the image?
Well, the image sort of came at the time, I think I was in my late teens or early 20s, and, you know, that time is always very dramatic, you know, very melodramatic time of life. And I think it came from a feeling of not feeling like I was connecting with anybody. I mean, it's a fairly universal feeling. I didn't see myself as the only person like this. You know, everybody around me seemed to have varying degrees of the same kind of feeling. So even though, you know, I was still a student, I wasn't doing films or anything, I did like to draw. So it did have graphic implications. It didn't have any filmic at the time.
What's interesting to me that as someone who liked to draw, you had this image of a boy who had scissors for hands, who couldn't use his hands in the way that normal people could, whereas for you, your hands were part of your gift.
Well, yeah, hands, yeah, it's always, it's funny, you know, you start thinking about things, and I don't know, I start to kind of zone out on things, and I start thinking about hands, and then it starts to get, I remember when I saw this movie, I remember going to a drive-in and seeing Fantastic Voyage. I remember that, where they shrink down inside to somebody's body.
Yeah.
And it started to freak me out because I just started to think too much about the inside of my body. So the same thing happened with hands. I just started to think a bit too much about it and had to stop. But it had less to do with hands than it did to do with a feeling of not being able to communicate. You know, again, since I was always fairly quiet and liked to draw, I would communicate pretty much just by drawings and not by speaking.
In the set of Edward Scissorhands, there's a castle at the end of the road of this suburban development. Did you wish that there was something like that in your neighborhood, something as exotic as this winding hill that leads up to an old castle?
Well, there was, you know, it's funny. It's like I think anywhere you live when you're growing up, whatever surroundings you have, there's always something or someone that's strange. There's always the weird guy down the street or the weird old dilapidated house or building or park or cemetery or whatever. There's always something. And so that's just a much more extreme version of that kind of thing.
What was it in your neighborhood?
Oh, we had several things. You know, we had a couple of weird people. We had a cemetery. It was a great park. You know, there's always someone or some old house in the neighborhood that gives, you know, something you got to talk about.
Tim Burton is my guest, and he directed the new movie Edward Scissorhands, as well as Batman, Beetlejuice, and Pee-wee's Big Adventure. What were the characteristics of the suburb where you grew up that you wanted to emphasize in the suburb of your new movie?
Well, again, wanting to do a fairy tale, I'd always found or linked certain images or certain sort of things of suburbia to a fairy tale. It's like the Avon lady is sort of the angel, and you know, she's like, it's like this cosmetic hope of the future kind of a thing. And just growing up in a kind of suburbia where it's very close, it's like a little kingdom in a way. You know, it's like a little fairy tale kingdom in the sense that, you know, it's like a real little microcosm. It's got its whole structure and class system and, you know, the kings and queens and dukes and princes of the neighborhood, and just this kind of bizarre imagery that I remember growing up with was, you know, these very white walls with weird ceramic things that nobody knew why they were there hanging on the wall, you know, resin grapes. What does that mean? I mean, it's just all of these very strange, very unusual, you know, images that I always somewhat linked to fairy tale imagery.
Can you describe how the hands for Edward were created?
Well, we wanted to do something that didn't rely heavily on special effects. You know, the most obvious technique would have been to have them mechanical and have like about four guys with cables running them. And since we just wanted to make this a simpler story and not make it so special effects heavy, the person I had do it, Stan Winston, who's great, who's a real good effects guy, designed it with the utmost simplicity in mind, so that the actor could just slip them on and know how it felt to feel that way. I mean, that was the most important thing to me, is that Johnny Depp could put them on and feel it and see what it felt like to have this kind of have these kind of hands. And since he's in every shot, it just made it much simpler. I mean, we'd still be shooting today, I think, if we hadn't done that.
How sharp were the blades on the scissors? And were there any accidents on the set?
Sure. Little pokes. And yeah, I got poked several times. I mean, they weren't real dangerous, but they were as dangerous as he was, you know. you know, even though they were made of a light metal thing, it wasn't, they were still, I got poked a few times.
So were they sharp?
Yeah. I mean, not razor sharp. I mean, I couldn't. I mean, he wasn't giving the crew haircuts and everything every, you know, 5 minutes between breaks or anything. But they were pretty sharp.
You started making Edward Scissorhands before you made Batman. But do you think you could have completed the movie without having had the success of Batman? Do you think that you would have, that a studio would have let you make the movie?
Yeah, well, you know, that's always a question, and I actually tried to make sure that the studio that I went to that they wanted to do it as much as I could tell they wanted to do it. You know what I mean? I you never know for sure, and obviously there is a lot of trust based on success and all of that sort of thing. So, but I did try to gauge how much of it was basically that, or how much of it was also that they wanted to do the movie. And I felt very good about that, too. So, yeah, I mean, there's no way to fully know what the percentage is, but, yeah, I'm sure that I know that figures into it, and I had hoped that it didn't figure in too much.
How come Edward Scissorhands wasn't made by Warner Brothers, who made your other three movies?
Well, they didn't. They just passed on it. Which I was happy about. I mean, I didn't want to get into a situation where they felt, you know, they wanted to do something that I, you know, that they didn't want to do. And so, even though I was upset that they didn't want to do it, I ultimately was very glad that they didn't want to do it, because, you know, you don't make these things on your own, so you really have to have people with you on something, and Fox was really good about that.
When you started making Scissorhands for Fox, did they give you what they give a lot of directors, which is a list of actors who you have to choose from as the lead, someone with a lot of box office mm-hmm. appeal?
Yeah, well, you go through the lists of people. I mean, they didn't say you got to use somebody from this, but you do go through that, and I understand it too, because I mean they're a studio, they're looking to you know to make their money and all that or whatever, and so but they weren't, you know, you just go through it with them, and you know, I sort of learned something on Beetlejuice, which is to be more open about you know, about casting and meet people and not go into something with a preconception. So I was very open about meeting people and enjoyed that, and was very happy that we arrived with Johnny Depp.
What did you learn from Beetlejuice about casting?
Well, you know, you just, it's like before you get into things, before you really get into making movies, you know, everybody, the biggest thing in Hollywood, everybody likes to talk. Oh, what about so-and-so? Oh, I don't like him. I've never liked so-and-so. Or I don't like this or I don't like that. And, you know, until you meet people, well, it's like Michael Keaton. I hadn't really seen any of his movies. I didn't really know him that well. And I don't know. You know, I don't really know. And then I met him and worked with him on Beetlejuice, and I just, you know, it was incredible. And it just, you know, until you meet somebody, and that's what becomes fun, because, you know, you change, people change. It's like acting, or it's, you know, it's, they're playing a character. So it becomes kind of wonderful. Sometimes you can twist something and make somebody something else, and that's actually the most fun. I mean, that really is why it's interesting to me. So I have now a very sort of open opinion or feeling about meeting people and just sort of seeing what they're like.
So who else was on the list for Edward Scissorhands?
Oh, well, you know, who's on the list of any, you know, I mean, it doesn't matter what the part is or what the, you know, there's always the same list, isn't there? I mean, it's,
well,
know,
well, I got Arnold Schwarzenegger is on this list, though.
No, there's a little. Well, maybe, you know, people like Tom Hanks, Tom Cruise. That was sort of the gist of the list.
Could you have imagined the movie with the Toms in it?
Well, I talked to them, and I enjoyed talking to them very much. As I said, It's funny, especially when you're it's different. If it's like a normal human being, it's much easier to talk to somebody and go, yeah, okay, Tom Hanks, Tom Cruise, Johnny Depp. But when you're talking about something that's you're just sort of making up, it's not, you know, it takes a little bit more time for me. I mean, even though I have a drawing or a concept or an idea, you know, you start to imagine somebody as something, and it takes on different personas. I mean, when I met Johnny, I certainly felt he was visually the clearest, you know, and could really relate and got the part. But, you know, you got to go through this other stuff, and it's good. It's not a bad thing to do.
Was Johnny Depp on the list?
Yeah, he was on the list.
Did you used to watch him in 21 Jump Street? I remember
no,
John
I never
Waters.
Saw him.
I remember John Waters telling the story of why he cast him in Crybaby. He said he'd gone to the store and bought up every fanzine he could get his hands on, and that Johnny Depp was on the cover of every one of them. So he realized, yeah, you know, like, if he needed to be true to the genre, he really had to hire Johnny Depp. And, you know, he's really happy with the way it turned out.
Yeah, no, I didn't see Jump Street, which I was sort of happy about. So I just met him, sort of just on his own. You know, I just met him and talked to him and really liked him from just talking to him. I mean, he really had passion for it, which was ended up being the main thing, really. You know, that ended up for me being the thing. You know, it's for me, it was much safer to say, let's go with somebody that has really feels really strongly about it than somebody who doesn't feel so strongly about it. I think it was more so than other roles. It was much more important to have that than maybe even somebody who was considered bigger box office and was a little bit more hesitant about things.
Now, one of the choices you made is really an homage. You have Vincent Price playing the role of the scientist in the castle who creates Edward Scissorhands. Were you a big fan of Vincent Price's movies when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah. Those were the movies that really sort of shaped me and helped me. They were just all those Edgar Allan Poe movies that I just could relate to completely. This just, you know, again, they're like fairy tales. They're abstract. You know, there's something about them that you can relate to, and yet it's, you know, it's certainly nothing literal because, I mean, here's people being buried alive and houses crumbling and caving in, that sort of thing, and people coming back to life. You know, that's not certainly something literal, but there was a very strong feeling, a very strong thing, like that kind of connection you can have with a fairy tale that I had with those movies. And, you know, and the first thing I ever did, a short film called Vincent, which was sort of something about him, he narrated, and so it was the first great experience I had in movies too. So it was he's really been great.
Was Vincent one of the shorts you made for Disney when you were working
there? Yeah.
What was it like for you working for the Disney Studios? You started as an animator, mm-hmm. and I guess it was when you got out of school you started to work for Disney for a few years. Did you feel that you fit into their sensibility? They have a much more upbeat sensibility than you do.
First year I was an animator's assistant and working on The Fox and the Hound, and it just drove me crazy because, number one, I wasn't really good at it, at that sort of thing. And there, you're really called upon to be the total artist and then the total factory worker at the same time. And I just couldn't make those two sides of my brain connect. It just drove me crazy. So I was very lucky. They let me sort of move on to just doing design work and my own things. And it was really nice of them to do. I mean, they didn't... It's kind of unusual circumstance that they let me do that.
What kind of criticisms would they give you?
You mean on my animation?
Yeah, or on your attitude?
Well, luckily, at the time anyway, animators were seen as eccentric, so you could pretty much hang by your heels from the ceiling and nobody would say much. I mean, I used to spend a lot of time in a little closet just sitting there in the dark. Nobody said too much. That was actually the best thing about it. I mean, you really could act however you want and not get into too much trouble.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is director Tim Burton, and he made the new movie Edward Scissorhands. He also directed Batman, Beetlejuice, and Pee-wee's Big Adventure. This is Fresh Air. Director Tim Burton is my guest. Your first movie was Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and this was really before Pee-wee Herman became a big star. The movie helped him become very well known. What was it like to work with him? Was he in persona at all? I mean, some people, I think, believe that Pee-wee Herman can't tell the difference between Paul Rubens, the real person, and Pee-wee Herman, the persona.
Well, it's not as schizophrenic as that. I think, it's a character he created, so it's something that is he has very much inside. It wasn't like, he is this character and then he, steps off and opens a beer and, starts watching football and has this big, deep voice. Or is he always the same? I mean, he just has the character inside, and I think that, he doesn't act that way all the time. But, it's when something is very strong, it's just there. That's probably the best way to say it. It's not as psychotic as whatever.
Do you know why you were asked to direct Batman? You hadn't ever done a big blockbuster before, and this was one of the most hyped and promoted films, I think, in the history of movie making. Were you surprised that you were offered the movie on the basis of Beetlejuice and Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
No, because I had a relationship with Warners, and they knew me, and they knew, I think they felt comfortable with me. it doesn't... With any kind of movie, and especially one with big budgets, I mean, it's always going to be a gamble. It's no matter who you have. And that's right. And so I was glad that they just, they were always very supportive of me in that way. And I they should have been, because I think, once you make the decision to let somebody do something, you better just, let them do it, because that's the way it has to happen. So, I think they just felt comfortable because I'd done two movies for them and basically, had the take on Batman. Batman had been around for like 10 years and with lots of different people attached to it. And, I guess lots of different takes on how to do the movie. And I guess they just liked the take that, we had on it too. So, all of those things combined just, wasn't a problem.
What was the take that you brought to the movie?
Well, there was always the TV show versus the new comic, which was very hardcore and violent and stuff. And I had, you know, I was not a big comic fan, and I basically grew up watching the TV show. And I always felt more like a normal person when it came to Batman, because I wasn't a comic book fan. I liked the TV show, and yet I loved the images of the characters. So I was a real Batman fan. I felt more like a normal, you know, because the factions between, you know, comic book people that are very, very passionate about comics and all hate the TV series, and then most people just know the TV series. The take that we had was somewhere in the middle. It's like to make it big and dark and sort of moody, but not completely cut out the humor, you know, keep it, because that's always been important to me in that, and just to you know, and the Joker was certainly a good avenue for that. So it was, you know, it was the idea to keep it big and dark and dramatic, yet not lose any of the, still have some humor in it.
Getting back to casting again, I thought it was very interesting to cast Michael Keaton as Batman and Jack Nicholson as his nemesis, because there's something very similar, I think, about them facially and also about their acting styles. As a matter of fact, when I saw Michael Keaton in Clean and Sober, he really kept reminding me of Nicholson at his best.
Yeah. Well, they both have the same eyebrows.
maybe that's it. And maybe hairline also. Well, yeah, formerly, yeah, anyways,
both,
before.
They're both actors that just, again, it's my favorite kind of actor. They just do it. You know, they're just fun to watch, and they're fun to work with, and you know, it's just a kind of actor that I really enjoy.
Now, I've read that your mother used to run, or perhaps still runs, a gift shop with a cat motif where everything sold has a cat on it.
Yes.
What did you think of that when you were young?
Well, I'm allergic to cats, so I don't think too much about it.
Well, how did you deal with when you were growing up?
Cute. Well, you know, it's just an abstract term to me. I mean, it's like... you know, cute to me means probably, you know, most times something quite horrifying and, you know, disturbing. I don't know.
Did you ever try to freak people out when you were young?
Oh, sure. Oh, we had a whole thing going. You know, we'd always prey upon the younger members of our neighborhood. And we faked a alien invasion in the park, you know, with creating a wreckage of a spaceship and footprints and stuff, and had convinced this kid that aliens had landed. I convinced the kids next door that I had murdered my brother. You know, horrible stuff.
Did your brother know about this?
Oh, yeah, no. We had a fake fight, and I killed him.
Do you see this as the foreshadowing of your career in movies?
Well, yeah, in a way, because I never had the real desire. I mean, I never had the goal that I wanted to make movies. I just like to do things. You know, I like to fool people, I guess.
Well, Tim Burton, thanks a lot for talking with us about your movies.
Sure.
And Tim Burton's new movie is Edward Scissorhands. He also directed Beetlejuice, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and Batman. Say, are you going to do the sequel, Batman 2?
Oh, I don't. I'm going to take a rest for a while, I think. In fact, I may just sleep here in the radio station. It's very quiet over here. I think I'll just stay here.
Next time on Fresh Air, director Robert Altman. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If Godfather 3, Look Who's Talking 2, and Three Men and a Little Lady aren't enough current sequels for you, we have suggestions for lots more from humorist Christopher Cerf, co-author of a new book featuring nothing but proposals for unnecessary sequels. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the first recording of John Harbison's cantata, The Flight into Egypt, based on a passage from the Gospel according to Matthew. And book critic John Leonard reviews Brian Boyd's new biography of Vladimir Nabokov. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney says that all U.S. forces will not be in place to launch a full attack on Iraqi troops by January 15th. Army Lieutenant General Calvin Waller, deputy commander of all U.S. forces in the Gulf, added it could be as late as mid-February before they are ready for combat. They made these assessments in Saudi Arabia, where Cheney is holding military briefings. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
Of the four services, only the Marines have said categorically they intend to be in place and ready for battle by January 15th. The Marines have an advantage because equipment had been pre-positioned aboard ships which remain at sea awaiting deployment. The Army's 7th Corps with three tank divisions has been slow in arriving from Europe and is considered critical to match Iraq's armor. The Air Force has about 650 combat aircraft in the region. 300 more are expected. The Navy is adding three carrier battle groups, but only one of the three has left port. After briefings in the Saudi capital of Riyadh, Cheney and Powell are expected to meet commanders and troops in the field. They leave for home on Sunday. I'm Ann Garrels in Saudi Arabia.
The people of Iraq have been told to stockpile oil in order to avoid shortages in case war breaks out. In Brussels, a NATO official is quoted as saying that Turkey has asked NATO to send several air units to beef up its frontier with Iraq. Turkey is said to want these units by the 15th of next month. In Washington, President Bush today reported progress in the nation's war on drugs, saying that drug use in the country has shown a marked decline. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more.
According to the government's latest household survey and emergency room data, there has been a 72% drop in the past 5 years and a 45% reduction in the rate of current cocaine use since 1988. Current is defined as having used cocaine at least once in the past month, but President Bush says the drug war has not been won.
Nevertheless, as long as there are hospital rooms filled with drug-affected babies, neighborhoods ravaged by drug violence, or children threatened by addiction, a declaration of victory would be premature.
The latest drug use figures show a far smaller drop in the use of marijuana. The government's figures are based on a survey of just over 9,000 people. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Construction of new homes moved up last month for the first time in 10 months. However, at the same time, the number of building permits went down. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed unchanged at 2,626.73. There was active trading of some 180 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 4-3.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, a talk with humorist Christopher Cerf. Composer John Harbison's cantata, The Flight into Egypt, won the Pulitzer Prize in Music a few years ago. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has been eagerly awaiting the release of a recording of the piece. Well, just in time for the holidays, Lloyd's wish has been granted.
John Harbison's wonderful cantata, The Flight into Egypt, is a setting of the passage in the Gospel of Matthew where an angel comes to Joseph in a dream and warns him that Herod is determined to destroy his child. Joseph takes Mary and the infant Jesus to Egypt, where they remain until the death of Herod. In the meantime, Herod orders the slaughter of all children under the age of 2. 2 years later, in Egypt, the angel reappears and the Holy Family returns and settles in Nazareth. Harbison says that this work grew out of conversations he had with the dedicated music makers at Boston's Emmanuel Church. For years, I think they've been among the true moral voices of the city, and not only in musical matters. Harbison says that in their discussion about the experience of counseling during the Christmas season, especially counseling the homeless, they agreed that given the widening gap between the fortunate and the less fortunate, the darker side of Christmas needed to be represented. The flight into Egypt is as much about homelessness as it is about the gospel. You can hear that sense of desolation in the winding, wandering music for two oboes and English horn that the cantata opens with. The flight into Egypt was commissioned by the Boston choral group, the Cantata Singers, and their music director, David Hoos. Harbison himself used to lead this group, and they are privileged with the first recording. Here are the two radiant soloists, baritone Sanford Sylvan singing the Evangelist, and soprano Roberta Alexander as the angel telling Joseph to arise and take his family to Egypt.
Behold, the angel of the Lord appeareth to Joseph in a dream, saying,
with its traditional solo obligatos and compact lyricism, The Flight into Egypt is a kind of contemporary equivalent of a cantata by Bach or Heinrich Schütz. But Harbison adds a trombone to the instruments of a Bach chamber orchestra and organizes his material around the most modern of musical techniques, the tone row. Some of the most wonderful passages are reserved for the chorus, in which Harbison competes with Bach and Schütz on their own turf. Here are the cantata singers led by David Hoos in the wondrous chorus singing the prophetic words, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." This recording also includes two other recent works by Harbison. A song cycle called The Natural World is Harbison's tribute to the landscape of rural Wisconsin, where he does most of his composing. Harbison himself conducts mezzo-soprano Janice Felty and the Los Angeles Philharmonic New Music Group in this setting of three American poems by Robert Bly, Wallace Stevens, and James Wright. There's also the exhilarating concerto for double brass choir and orchestra. Harbison calls this music public, blunt, and ceremonial. He says he composed it to celebrate the brass section of the LA Philharmonic, and they respond brilliantly under the guiding hand of Andre Previn.
Willard Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed The Flight into Egypt and other works by John Harbison on the New World label. This is Fresh Air. If you enjoyed the book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, how about the sequel, Judaism and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, The Fabulous Journey of a Man with No Sense of Direction? If you're a poetry lover, you might prefer the sequel to the Norton Anthology, the Ed Norton Anthology of Underground Poetry. These and dozens of other spin-offs are proposed in the new Book of Sequels, co-authored by humorist Christopher Cerf. The authors are sure there's lots of money in literary sequels, as well as the more obvious movie sequels. They took their inspiration from one publisher's decision to pay $4.9 million for a sequel to Gone with the Wind. Chris Cerf was a co-founder of the National Lampoon, has written many song parodies for Sesame Street, and is the co-author of several other humor books. In the new book, he proposes a spin-off of Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, Godot Action Comics.
We figure that some people have found the original Waiting for Godot a little impenetrable, a little dull sometimes, not much action. So we figured an action comic is what we needed to bring that to a broader audience, which of course is our main purpose in doing this book.
Who did you get to illustrate the Godot action comics?
It was done by a fellow named Russ Heath, who has done a lot of, you know, sort of Marvel Comics work and old classic comics and is really right for the style. And it really came out great.
It's great because it's these action guys kind of sitting around brooding.
Well, there isn't much for them to do. That's true. They examine a bush for a while, and then they stand and talk about that for a while, and they just, you know, they wait for Godot, just like the original. I think we've really caught the spirit of the original.
One of the many things that you've been doing over the years is writing songs, those little rock and roll parodies for Sesame Street.
That's right.
Did you want to be a rock and roll? Did you want to have a rock and roll band when you were younger?
Oh, absolutely. I think it was definitely a dream. And the great thing about Sesame Street is that if you don't mind that your audience is only 3 years old, you can do anything you want. You know, I mean, you can be a rock star one day, you can write an opera the next day, or a showbiz tune the next day. And we try to do a little bit of all of that. And the main thing on that show has been that we want the adults to like it too. The rule is that you can't write something that the kids won't understand at all and know that they didn't understand it so that they feel that they've been left out. But if you can do something that works on their level that also amuses the adults, that just increases the audience and makes the adults watch with the kids, and all that's good for the learning. So it's really encouraged.
There's a new collection of Sesame Street rock and roll videos. And one of the songs that you wrote for that collection of videos, or that's featured on that collection of videos, is "I Can't Get No Cooperation," performed by the Cobblestones.
Right.
are there copyright laws that you have to obey when you're parodying famous people's famous songs?
Absolutely. Though nobody knows exactly what the rules are, but you really don't copy the tune. You have to try to suggest the tune and suggest the words, but you can't use the original ones. And if you do, you can be sued. But most of the time, we stayed away from that. You know, that came up in the sequels book, too. We were going to do a parody of featuring the Bambi characters of a movie called Bambo that was going to be a cross between Rambo and Bambi. And the line that went with it was that they killed his mother. Now it's time to get even. And in fact, we'd made a little postcard of that and brought it to the book convention. And we were notified very quickly that there would be injunctions against the book and all kinds of things if we tried to use those characters. So we left it out finally. And indeed, that was a case where we had gone over the line, because we were using not just a copyrighted name, you know, and certainly parody is encouraged by free speech, but you can't use trademarks. And the Bambi character was a trademark. So there are rules. Nobody knows exactly where the line is, but parody is generally okay as long as you can see that it's not trying to trade on the original.
titles. You can parody titles without any problems.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, sure.
Have you ever been sued?
Actually, yes. We were sued for a Sesame Street song called Letter B that was a parody of Let It Be. We weren't sued by the Beatles, who in fact wrote an affidavit on our behalf, but by someone who had bought the copyright to that song, an Australian firm. And eventually it was settled out of court. But it does make you stop and think. And probably we might have gotten a little closer than we should have to that tune. Actually, it was settled for $500, so it looks like we would have won the case if it had gone all the way.
Yeah, that's not exactly a grand settlement.
No, since they originally sued us for $5.5 million, I figure $500 was a pretty good settlement. The funny part of that was that Michael Jackson by this time owed the company, so I had to write the check to Michael Jackson, who I'm sure needs the money more than I did.
Well, let's see what you did with I Can't Get No Cooperation by the Cobblestones. You wrote the music for this, yes?
Yes, I wrote the music and tried to do a Mick Jagger imitation as well, though.
Oh, you're singing on that?
Yeah, though, you'll see that it doesn't sound too much like him.
Well, that means he won't sue you.
Well, we hope not. Well, I'm sitting on a seesaw seat, thinking seesawing would be me. And I can't find a friend to sit on the other side. Yes, I tried it all alone, but I crashed down like a stone. Couldn't get no cooperation if I tried. No, 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 no cooperation. No, 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 no cooperation. No, 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 no cooperation if I tried. If I tried.
There's a Muppet based on you who sometimes sings the songs that you wrote. Who designed the Muppet?
Actually, it was based on a Muppet that Jim Henson designed years ago called Fat Blue. In fact, if you watch Sesame Street closely, you'll see that Fat Blue character is the basis of a lot of things that are known as anything Muppets. You slap a different wig on them or glasses or a different costume, and they look different. And basically what they did was put curly hair that looked a little like mine and glasses that looked a little like mine on the Fat Blue Muppet and gave him a piano, which usually gets broken in the course of performing any of these songs, and I get to sing, which is really fun.
What's it been like to work on Sesame Street since the death of Jim Henson? How have you been affected by that, in terms of your work?
Well, it's been a very sad year because not only Jim Henson, but Joe Raposo, who was our principal composer, died within the last year as well. So, I mean, I think really all of us have been doing this so long. It's hard to believe, but the show is in its 22nd year now. But because we all stayed together pretty much, you don't really feel that all that time has passed. And I don't think any of us expected these things to happen. And Joe and Jim, of course, are still pretty young guys, or would have been. So we took it pretty hard. But I think, you know, the show will go on. And, of course, Jim built an incredible group of performers, and all the rest of them are still there. A lot of those characters were played by other people. So really only Kermit and Ernie are missing at the moment, and we have 20 years of them on tape. So the show looks pretty much the same still. I think it made us all feel what a family we all were, you know, so that we've all gotten even closer, and everybody worked extra hard to fill the gap. So it's been an exciting year in a way, though it's certainly been a sad one.
Did the Sesame Street people do anything at the funeral about their work for Sesame Street?
Well, there was work included because some of Jim's most famous work was on our show. And one of the nicest moments, I think, was that Carol Spinney, who plays Big Bird, appeared in the bird costume and sang It's Not Easy Being Green, which, since he was yellow, would sound weird, but it was incredibly touching and made everybody cry. The whole service was remarkable because it was filled with music and puppet performances and jokes.
Yeah.
Jim had left instructions in a series of letters that he wrote of exactly what songs he wanted at his funeral, which included things like Lydia the Tattooed Lady. But the whole thing was, it just made it all sadder. But definitely there were Sesame Street characters and things included throughout.
Why do you think he wrote down instructions for his death? Do you think he had any idea he was going to go?
I don't, really, though. I mean, Jim was a very spiritual, kind of mystical guy. I mean, besides all the nonsense, he had that side. And one of the letters said that he was interested in death, but that I don't think he was expecting it quite so quickly. He also said that you might think this is a little weird, but you can't argue with me now, can you, because I'm gone. You know, the letters were very funny, but of course, when you hear something funny under those circumstances, it just makes you fall apart, which is what we all keep doing even several months later.
Right. How did you get started in comedy?
Gosh, that's a hard question. I think a combination of things. My dad was Bennett Cerf, who was a publisher first, but loved to collect jokes. So we had a lot of jokes at our house. And I think I never could compete with him as a joke teller, so I kind of got more interested in conceptual comedy. But I certainly learned to see the silly side of things. And then when I got off to Harvard, I went out for the Harvard Lampoon and made it. And a lot of the people I still work with have had a lot to do with the Lampoon over the years. In fact, Henry and Doug started National Lampoon, Henry Beard and Doug Kenny, because they just didn't want to stop doing Harvard Lampoon when college ran out. And that gave us all a chance to go back and keep doing what we loved doing so much in college. And in fact, you know, doing things like the sequels book or writing these silly songs for Sesame Street is really the same job that I've had since I was a kid. So I've never had to grow up.
I want to change gears for a minute and end on end with something for the kids. You know, everybody's shopping for holiday gifts. And you have a suggestion from the Book of Sequels. If you don't want to buy Nintendo, you've got something else.
Yes, we do. We noticed that there hadn't been much existentialist literature brought into the field of video games. And we decided that was an important and valuable thing to do. So we've developed Albert Camus' Myth of Sisyphus video game. It works very well at first. You push the rock up a hill and you get a lot of points. But before you're through, every time, in fact, the rock will turn on you. You have to chase it. It will catch up with you, and you will end up losing to the rock very badly.
And the game is called?
Albert Camus' Myth of Sisyphus video game from the Existendo video game company, who also have a wonderful interactive videotape of Crap's Last Tape. And No Exit, No Exit, by the way, is another wonderful Existendo game. Again, you can play for a long, long time without winning, which we feel a lot of people will want to do since they're going to die anyway, let's face it.
There
eventually.
Well, Christopher Cerf, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Christopher Cerf co-authored the new humor book, The Book of Sequels, and some of his song parodies are included on the new Sesame Street home video, Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Today we're going to take a look at our troops in the Persian Gulf and ask the question, are we ready, and if not, why not, and when will we be, to go to war, if that is what happens. And the administration takes a crack at American public opinion on the Persian Gulf situation. We're also going to see if we can get any clearer on exactly what the administration means to do about minority-restricted scholarships and what sort of precedent there is for restricting scholarship aid to minority students.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Book critic John Leonard says Vladimir Nabokov is the greatest writer never to have received a Nobel Prize. There's a new biography of Nabokov by Brian Boyd, and John has this review.
Vladimir Nabokov seems not to have dreamed, at least not very often in his first 40 years, or else he repressed those dreams. His intrepid and worshipful biographer, Brian Boyd, reports just two in these 600 pages. The first is a trifle. The second is more fraught. When Nabokov was 18, writing poems, loving women, and ignoring the Bolshevik Revolution, he was struck down by appendicitis. Under ether, he imagined himself in a sailor suit, being cut up like one of his famous butterflies. My own vitals were being exposed, he reported. The soaking, ice-cold absorbent cotton pressed to the insect's Lemurian head, the subsiding spasms of its body, the satisfying crackle produced by the pin penetrating the hard crust of its thorax. Well, you'd give up anesthetics, too, and maybe even dreaming, if that's what happened when you lost control of your consciousness. It's clear from this first volume, covering Nabokov's years in St. Petersburg and Berlin, that he was a hero of consciousness. He'd find in anything at all deeper and deeper meanings, patterns, harmonies, butterflies pinned to a chessboard, sunsets and mirrors in stained glass, anagrams all of his own brilliant making. His was an art for life's sake, Boyd tells us. If you can't go back to the past, you can, if you're clever enough, create what Nabokov called intangible property, unreal estate, as rich as the Byzantine imagery of the Orthodox Church he disdained, as he disdained Freud, Marx, Darwin, and every other determinism of the 19th and 20th centuries. Deaf to music, indifferent to politics, opposed to the very idea of a future, this chain-smoking insomniac, amateur boxer, semi-pro tennis player, womanizing lyric poet, having been chased out of Russia by Lenin and out of Germany by Hitler, went into a lifelong exile with his jigsaw puzzles, his magic kits, and his symbolist booklets, wearing spats in a derby, to dream in novels of artist madmen and artist criminals, of insanity and suicide, of strangled wives and slaughtered sons and debauched nymphettes. He was, we are told, a happy man. If you think you already know enough about Nabokov from his own triumphant autobiography, Speak Memory, or from the novels in which he reworked every shred of his life, think again. Boyd, a New Zealand critic, recasts every poem and story, and revisits every square foot of Prague, Cambridge, and the Crimea. We meet Nabokov's martyred father, a diplomat and newspaper editor, his gun-toting mother, who converted to Christian Science, his Russian-Jewish wife, Vera, who appeared first at a costume ball, wearing a black mask wolf's head. From Boyd's wealth of anecdote, we construct our own Nabokov, out of his doubles and pseudonyms, resentments and obsessions, the perfect modernist, a labyrinth of mirrors. I wonder what accounts for his hatred and fear of homosexuals. What if he had accepted the offer to ship out as a stoker on a boat to Indochina? What if Vera had slept around? What if he had to kill Dostoevsky in his literary criticism because he hadn't been allowed in real life to kill his own perfect father? A right-wing assassin did it for him. What if the author of The Gift, Pale Fire, and Ada seethed to the end in a rage for Zembla or Antiterra or some other insect world of his own feverish imagination? Tune in next year for Volume 2, The American Years.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Vladimir Nabokov, The Russian Years by Brian Boyd. Our reviews are produced by Naomi Person, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy, Rupert Ashurak, and Sue Spolin. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Robert Altman, the director of MASH, Nashville, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and Tanner 88. His new movie, Vincent and Theo, is about Vincent van Gogh and his brother. Also, actress Kathy Bates tells us about making the scene you most want to forget in the movie Misery. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.